Okay, so this morning I didn't forget this one. Better. It's better, especially because it stays always in the same place. So registration is recording is even. Okay, so just service communication, because I have we have started part three, and we are not so disconnected, of course, with the other parts, but I didn't give you the research paper and textbook before, in advance, as I promised, just because I was not sure what paper I wanted to give you. Now, finally, I found a very recent review on transcription factors that is very good. It accounts for the most recent data and developments on the field. And also I found a paper that is concerning a very novel aspect. That means that today we are getting close to consider enhancer and promoter more or less the same story. So anyway, you will see what is the story. So now they are open. You can see on the Moodle side they are open, so you have the stories. There are actually three textbooks for this chapter because it's the longest one, so several things. But as I promised, only one research paper. Okay. So let's start again. Of course, you have. We can start from the very first review that you had in your story, and I know that most of you have actually read it. Morning. So that probably you have gone through this review that was actually resuming most of the subjects. Okay, so I think that if you have read it, you are already at a good level, we can actually discuss everything in detail. So, okay, so the first thing that actually this review was saying, the introduction, is a very important concept, as you know, that this transcriptional regulation is the primer mechanism underlying differential gene activity in animal development and disease. So the concept is differential gene activity, that as you know better than I do, is the key to make differential cell activity, differentiation, development, growth, apoptosis, response to stimuli, response to drugs, disease, whatever. This is everything actually goes through differential gene activity. Okay? So what we are trying to understand in this part is, can you open the other door? So just so the people can enter the other door and not pass it. It's better. Thank you. Okay. So just a few lines below in the review, there was recent efforts indicate that the human genome likely contains hundreds of thousands of enhancers. With a typical gene embedded in a media of tens of enhancers. This is a completely novel concept. If you study oldest books of molecular biology, they always show you a scheme in which you have a gene, a promoter, and one enhancer. And they show how the enhancer interact with the promoter to drive transcription. But this is a real new concept that has come essentially from the post-genomic projects, as we have seen already the ENCODE, principally the ENCODE, but actually it's not the only one. There are other projects that are running. But just to repeat and to concentrate on it, to focus, ENCODE, as I told you already, started just in parallel with the release of the very first version of the genome. And actually, until 2007, they went through classical Sanger sequences. As you remember, cloning in Sanger is a pain in the neck. It's very, very difficult. So that the goal of this first part of the ENCODE project was just to look at the 1% of the human genome. So they chose some regions in chromosomes, okay, that were no more than 1% of the entire genome, and started to look for finding promoters in answer, transcripts and whatever, but only limited to that part, okay. But even though, and that, of course, the project scaled up very rapidly after the NGS release in the, as you know. So this is the first paper. It made something like 12 years ago. It was published in 2007. And so it is concerning the 1%, as you see here, targeted 1% of the human genome. But even was a very limited part of the genome, they already seen that there was a very, very impressive transcription. 75% of the regions that they examined were transcribed, they were represented in RNA. So this was the real novel. And the second thing is that they have seen a number of regulatory chromatin structures that were unexpected, okay? So then, as I told you, after this, they started with NGS, so the project increased a lot, there was quicker, they included many more cell lines, tissues, species, and whatever. And then they published it in 2012, what many scientists consider, again, a revolution. There was several revolutions in biology, actually. And because in September 2012, the ENCODE project consortium published something like 30 papers, 30, 30 papers all together in Nature, showing all the results they got. So it was a kind of enormous knowledge arriving to the scientific community. Kind of very, very, very big project anyway. So just to make the story short, and what is most concerning to us today is that they found that examining each single nucleotide of the human genome sequence, they found that 80% of the human genome participate in at least one biochemical event. This is a kind of cryptic sentence, but the meaning, if you can translate it, means that 80% of the genome nucleotide is inside a significant sequence. That means either a promoter or an enhancer, or is a coding sequence, or is a transcribed sequence, or whatever. Okay, so this is the original formulation, so it's a little cryptic, and means that has a significance, a function, okay? Then second very good news, the important news is that 2/3 of genomic sequences are represented in RNA. So completely contrary to what was thought before, before the ENCODE, we thought that actually a very little part of the genome was transcribed, okay? 2/3, that means something like 66%, 67% of the genome is actually represented in RNA. Of course, all this RNA is not coding, but it's a different... You have seen already the catalog of the RNA, so some sense, okay? And so what is even more concerning our discussion today is that they found something like 400,000 sites that show chromatin features of enhancers. You remember we had a slide a couple of lessons ago in which you remember that there are typical marks in the histones, you remember, that are close to the enhancer regions. That are, first of all, there are isoforms of the histones, H3.3, H2A.Z. Then you have marks like 27X acetylated or K4 monomethylated or dimethylated. Okay, so there are marks. So they found something like 400,000 sites, and this actually is extremely higher than the number of predicted genes. Okay, just looking at the protein coding genes, you remember the figure, we had less than 20,000 protein coding genes. Then we have another more or less 20,000 long non-coding genes and some microRNA genes. But summing up, we may arrive to something like 50,000. Okay, so the genes, the promoters, are more or less 50,000, and then you have something like 10 times enhancers. Okay, actually, you see here 70,000 regions as a promoter-like features is a little higher than what I said just before. 50,000, but just because, as you remember, many genes have different transcription start site, so one gene more than one promoter. Okay. Anyway, this figure is something like saying that each gene has something like 8 to maybe more enhancer controlling it. This is the ratio. Okay, and actually there is an estimate, because of course the ENCODE project has studied many cell types, but not all of them, many tissues, but not all of them, and not in all the developmental situation. Is that clear? So you can estimate that if you are able to study all possible tissues and cells and development stages, you arrive to something like 1 million enhancers. This is the estimate today. Okay. So the concept is, the take-home message is that we have an enormous number of regulatory regions to a relatively few genes. Okay. Okay, just let me go back to the ENCODE experiment for a moment, just to show. We have gone already, so don't worry for that. But are you doing anything with bioinformatics for this? Nothing at all? Are you looking at the browser or so? No. No worry. So just to tell you, this is a matrix. I don't know if you spent a minute for looking at the matrix. I may make an exercise for you, but it's just to show that the situation today is this one. Okay, so you have something like 15,000 results in analysis, genomic-wide analysis. Okay, and there are different cell lines. We have a lot of those. If you look at the paper published in 2012, they were saying 147 cell lines. As you can see today, the number increased to 254 plus the five. So we are more or less 260 cell lines examined. And on this section, they made a lot of ChIP-seq analysis, that is essentially to transcription factors or to histone modifications, right? So the stories. Then DNA-seq, that you remember what it is, we described it. And then, you see, this is expression. So RNA, okay? So expression analysis. And these are the numbers. So what you see, for example, for this line that is a kidney something, you have something like more than 600 experiments genome-wide with different transcription factors and with different modification to history. So we have a view that is quite complete. This is the reason why I chose the recent review on transcription factor, because the data are really, you know, accumulating a very rapid pace today. So it's better to have a journal view on this. Okay. There are also tissues here, as you can see, liver, stomach. These are tissues that are taken in human, are taken for post-mortem individuals. There is a collection that is called GTEx. This is made with post-mortem tissues. And for animals, of course, you know, they are taken from animals, from mouse or whatever. And there are, as you can see, 155 more than what you see there. So number of tissues also is very high. There is also analysis of whole organism and carcass, that means the post-mortem, but non-human in this case, and primary cells. This is a very difficult story because, as you know, establishing a primary cell line is not really easy. Okay, you can take primary cells and then you can culture them in the normal tissue media and so on, but they stay alive for very few days, very very little. Okay, so you cannot increase the amount of cells. It's very difficult, and so you have a thin amount of material to carry out the stories. Okay, so as you can see, the numbers are not equal to the other ones, much less. But they are important because, of course, when you have established cell lines, we discussed it already, they are mostly oncological derivation, so they are cancer cell types, most of them, or immortalized artificially or spontaneously. But when a cell immortalized means that something happened to the genome, okay? Either recombination, activation of something. Anyway, it's not normal. Okay. So this is a particularly important story. Then we can go through, and wherever you go to one of these figures. Wait, I'm going to see this first. Okay, this is the long list of all the experiments, and just to say that not all of the cell lines have this huge number of experiments, of course. Okay, so your favorite cell line, maybe that in a short time you will be in the lab to prepare your thesis, I hope for you, 6 months or 10 months or whatever, you will be in the lab and you will probably most likely working with a cell line. So it is very likely that your cell line will be here in the list, okay? And if you are fortunate, maybe that is in the top list, so you have all the data that you want there, okay? If you are less fortunate, maybe it's in the bottom, so relatively few experiments for that line, okay? But for example, in my laboratory, we are working with this guy. This guy is MCF7, is a breast cancer cell line. Okay, it's the sixth ever, and so we have a lot of experiments, right? And so we have a lot of data to look at. Okay? To play, as the bioinformatics say, to play with. Anyway, that's the story. I go back to my presentation because we are going to lose all our time there, but you can go. I mean, it's just up to you. Okay. So there are two very famous papers in the 30 that I told you in 2012, and this is the one that was examining the regulatory network of transcription factors, but we are not going to examine, just to tell you. And the other one was this one. Regulatory lexicon encoded in transcription factor footprints. Just to show you that most of the things that you see in your review test book are taken from these studies. Okay. Good. So, talking with regulatory regions, as I told you before, we are dealing essentially with promoters versus enhancers. And since today there is a kind of mixing of the two concepts, it's probably better to formalize a little bit. Okay, so what is a promoter? What is an enhancer? Oh, the first definition of promoters is that it should be preceding and overlapping the transcription star site. Okay, so whatever is the regulatory sequence that is not overlapping the TSS is not a promoter. Okay, so the promoters are there as a definition. There is, it's not a law written in the tables of law, but it's our definition of promoters. While enhancers are placed in virtually, oh, this is Italian, virtually, virtually in different regions around the gene. That means that they can be downstream, upstream, or even within the introns of a gene, so they are completely random. Okay. I gave you a definition that is 1,000 base pair as a limit upstream or downstream the gene, but it's just a statistical story. I mean, we know that the enhancers can be found wherever. Okay, and there is no strict definition. When the bioinformatics guy explore a gene for an answer, they usually go in a window of 100 base pair upstream and downstream. So this is the reason why we define it like this. You will see in the during the next discussions that actually there is no limit. You can have an enhancer working on a gene that is 1 million bases behind. So, but the main story is that the promoter should precede the gene. This can be wherever. And in the very far past, people try to make deletions or even to take an enhancer and to bring it in another position in the genome of whatever it works. So they are defined as a position independent and distance independent regulatory regions, right? Okay, so again, as a definition, the promoter is a minimal sequence. Okay, so this is the definition that we give. Okay, core promoters is something like -4 to just not to make you confused about the definition. -4 T to +40 base pairs in respect to TSS. This is the physical definition in the sense that if we take a gene and we make a footprint, I don't know if you know what is a footprint, but we will see shortly, okay? You see that part that is occupied by RNA polymerase and factors. Okay, so you can define physically the promoter is there. But when you go to bioinformatic guys looking for promoters, they usually make something like even 150 base pair upstream. So this is depending on the choices. There is no real definition of the promoter. There is a functional definition. That is, I can take the promoter, I can take the sequence and put it in front of a reporter gene. Do you know what is a reporter gene? Some of you knows. We will see a slide after that. Okay, and you can try to delete it progressively. At one point you have no activity anymore, so this is the minimal promoter, of course. Okay, so this can be bioinformatic or functional or footprints or whatever, so you have different measures, different sizes. Just think about it. Then we have this definition of enhancers, okay, but the story is that usually you have also a kind of enhancer that is just in front, upstream of the promoter, the minimal promoter. Most of the genes have regulatory sequences that are just upstream the promoter. Okay, and again, if you ask a bioinformatic guys, usually they use something like 500 to 2,000 bases upstream the TSS, and usually they include also +100 in the examination. Okay, because statistically you can find regulatory activity in that region. Okay, so This is promoter that usually comprises also upstream regulatory sequence, and these are announcer that actually as a function, so if you consider the functional activity, are just the same as the upstream regulatory sequence. Okay. Okay. This is the same, so just keep it. And just to make a scheme of what I told you is that, okay, if you look at a gene, okay, we can call transcription unit taking from the farther upstream plus one, okay, when you have different transcriptions that side, going to the very end, the last, the longest transcription. This is we call transcription unit. And always you have a promoter there, okay? And also you have regulatory sequences that are considered part of the promoter, okay? Then you have announcers. The answers are whatever. They can be also in introns, so you don't see them here because of the limitation of space. They are upstream, many, many different parts, or downstream the gene, many, many different parts, and they bind to transcription factors, right, that are these ovals there. Okay, so there is sequence element in the DNA and transcription factor that may or may not bound to them. Okay, these are enough. And as you see, when I told you that the promoter regulatory, proximal regulatory sequence are considered at the same functional activity of the enhancer is just because they bind to the same transcription factors. Okay, so they are transcription factor binding site that instead to be wherever in the locus, they are adjacent to the promoter. That's it. Okay. So you probably remember, but in the next lesson we will examine this in detail, that promoters bind to a special category of transcription factor. Do you remember how they are called? Try to dig in your mind for souvenirs that you don't remember. In the very proximal region, there are factors that are the determinants of RNA polymerase binding. Do you remember how they are called? In prokaryotes, you have a direct binding of RNA polymerase. You have only a subunit that is the sigma subunit. Do you remember? Sigma polymerase. Here we have a more complicated story. We have transcription factors that are called TF2 and the letter. Remember that? TF2A, TF2B, TF2D, and blah, blah. They are multi-component, and they build up a complex to the promoter. There is one of those that is called the TBP, the Tata binding protein, whatever, you probably remember that. Just trying to re-emerge your concept, okay? And everything, when the polymerase binds to it, okay, the polymerase lends to this complex of proteins, is an enormous complex, actually. It's 50 proteins together. Kind of subunit. And this is called a PIC, that stands for pre-initiation complex. So it's the complex that is there to initiate, pre-initiation complex. And these factors, TF2 letter, are called general transcription factors because they are always in a promoter, okay? So they are not DNA sequence specific as the other regulatory factors are. They are typical only of the promoters, okay? Good for the moment. And then, of course, we have transcription factors all around. Okay, so what we are trying to understand today is transcription factors and the elements of DNA that are bound by transcription factors. Okay. So all the regulatory modules, this is a module, this is a module, this is a module, okay, contain segments of DNA where short sequence motifs that usually are from 4 to 15 base long, that we call response elements, are recognized by specific transcription factors, and they are juxtaposed. Juxtaposed means that they are one following the other one, following the other one. Okay? There is virtually no regulatory element in our genome that binds only one transcription factor. Practically all the regulatory modules that we know, either in the proximal promoter or in answers, they are composed. Okay? So they have different small motifs of sequence, okay, which can bind different transcription factors. So in a combinatorial way, we will discuss that. So definition that we call it response elements, in the sense that they are the element of DNA that respond to the transcription factor, but from a general genomic view of this phenomenon, we call them TFBS, that stands for transcription factor binding sites. This is an operational definition, this is a functional definition. So just same, okay? But remember 4 to 15. We don't know any element in the DNA binding transcription factor that is shorter than 4. We don't know anything that's larger than 15. Okay, so this is your textbook. And as you can see, it's a very recent review. It was published in December last year. So, okay, this is the date. This is the DOI. And it can look a little complicated in the first figures, but you will see that we are discussing today in slides the different figures that are simpler. But if you understand the simpler slides, you can move to your book quite easily. Okay. So this is discusses something like a catalog that we have today of over 1,600 likely human TFs and binding motifs. For 2/3 of them, please try to interpret what is written there. Okay? This review considers how TFs are identified and functionally characterized, principally through the lens of a catalog, so the catalog that we have today, ENCODE plus other catalogs, and blah, blah, blah. 1,600 likely human TFs and binding motifs for 2/3 of them. Means 2/3 of them means that actually the estimation of the number of transcription factors in our genome is this number by 3 divided by 2. Okay, this 1,600 is 2/3 of the total number of transcription factors estimated in our genome. In other words, we estimated our genome encodes for 2,400 different transcription factors. Okay? And why likely? Why likely? A catalog of over 1,600 likely human TF. Why likely? You can understand this adverb there, because not for all of them we have direct proof being a real transcription factor. Okay, so for many, you remember the numbers that we see on ENCODE. We have enormous number for something, little number for others, and the same for transcription factor. We have a number of experiments for some of them and very little experiment for the rest. Okay, so okay, transcription factors means that this number that I told you means that actually you have more or less 10% of the coding potential of our genome is spent in transcription factors, actually. We have 20,000 proteins, 20,000 genes encoded for proteins. We have more than 2,000, so it means that 10% is spent in proteins controlling the version of the genome. Okay, it's quite enormous. Okay, all the transcription factors that we know recognize DNA motifs, so small DNA sequences, by multiple chemical interaction between amino acids, residues of their DNA binding domain. Remember this acronym, we will find it several times, DBD. And 4 to 6 base pair in the major group. Is this sentence telling you anything? Have you seen already in your life a crystal structure of a TF binding to DNA? No. Maybe not. Okay, anyway, this is a DNA binding element, okay? Skip this sentence we will discuss later on. But then the transcription factor is not the only activity of binding DNA and stuff. It also has different domain that we call transactivating domain, okay? That is the other domain that communicates to the machinery for transcription. Okay, so one domain is the DNA recognizing element. The other domain is the one that communicates with simplified RNA polymerase. Okay? We will study all these guys there shortly. So I put a green advertisement here that actually is supposed you to know yourself, but maybe you don't. I don't know. Actually, there was no enthusiastic yes when I asked you for that. So there are many databases for TF for transcription factors. Is one of those, and this is a structure repository you know already. There are many motifs. Do you remember these motifs like this one? This, I just put some of them, but probably you know them. This one is what is called homeobox. Have you seen it already? It is typical of the homeotic protein that we have discussed yesterday. You remember in Monday we discussed about the OxD, they contain many transcription factors that are this class. And as you can see here in this slide, you see that this is a actually this homeobox domain is composed of 3 helices that are typically in the space like 1, 2, and 3, as you see here. And the third helix is placed like this in the figure. So you have to imagine an helix that comes from you to the screen, okay? And as you can see, there are projections of the amino acids going outside the helix. Okay, you remember alpha helix as a skeleton, and then all the amino acid residues go away. Okay, so these are residues, and you see that they make contacts with a couple of bases here. Okay, so and this is a major groove of DNA. You see, this is major groove. This is minor groove. But going through the major groove, one transcription factor has access to 4, maybe 5 base pair. Okay, so it can put amino acids over there, and with normal chemical interaction like hydrogen bonding or salt bridges or hydrophobic interaction, whatever, it recognizes the pair. Okay. Also, the stability of the transcription factor is determined by basic amino acid going to make bridges to the what is here in the DNA. What is here? You remember what is here? Phosphate. Okay. So there is a stability binding, not specificity binding, that is due to basic amino acid, two phosphates, and then specificity interaction that are this projection inside the major groove to the base pair. There is also a code. You haven't studied that? Really? There is a code for recognizing the different pairs of base, no? I'm not here today, but I can bring it to you tomorrow morning. Okay, anyway, this is a Omeo box domain. This is a zinc finger. Zinc finger because you see that here you have alpha helix and then you have a beta sheet here composed by two strands, and there are residues like cysteine or histidines, see, that coordinate an atom of zinc, a zinc ion inside. Okay, this is typical of many factors like Gal-4, steroid receptor, nuclear receptors, whatever. And this one is the helix that is placed inside the major groove for recognition. Okay. Then we have another typical transcription factor family that is the one that makes this kind of, it's called the leucine zipper, because you see that it's a continuous alpha helix and another continuous alpha helix. This is a dimer, of course. And this part of the helix is as a typical structure of leucines. Have you ever seen it? Leucines. Since it's typical, every 7 amino acids you have a leucine. Because you probably remember the alpha helix makes 3.5 turn. 3.5 amino acids per term in the alpha helix. So when you make 7, you have projection of the amino acid in the same direction. So you have to imagine here a kind of zipper of leucines, okay, that are hydrophobic, so they keep the two dimers together. And here's the basic region, so you have many basic amino acids there. And again, you see that the alpha helix is in the major groove, recognizing the base pairs. Okay. A different version of the same story is this kind of helix, turn helix, or helix loop, depending on the size of the loop helix. And this typical of MYC, for example, myodine, neurodine, probably heard about these factors. And this chiral response binding protein that are this kind of story again. There are many, actually. DNA binding domain are very easy to crystallize because they are rigid, they have a shape that is fixed, okay? And when they bind to the DNA with high affinity, so you can make the protein binding to the small oligonucleotide and then crystallize. It's very easy. So virtually all the transcription factors have at least one crystal structure in the database with DNA. Okay. On the contrary, the transactivation domain, so the other domain, one that communicates with the transcriptional machinery, is undefined. Usually is not folded when you isolate it, because to be folded correctly, it needs interaction with other proteins. And so we know that there are many kinds of transactivated domain based on the composition, but not based on the structure. Okay, very few of them have a crystal structure. So, just to show you the two databases here. This is the DBD, transcription factor prediction database, and there are many. You can search looking for a specific, like putting MYC or AP1 or FOS or whatever, and then you will get all the information and stories that are inside. And the other one was RSCB, this is the structure we visited already, this database. Can we suggest a factor to look at? Do you have a favorite factor? Nobody. Okay. Let me see. Let me see crab. Do you know what is crab? Do you know what is crab? Cyclic AMP response element binding proteins. The factor that responds to cyclic AMP. Never heard? Really? I'm surprised by neurology. Neurologists always know crabs. Anyway, no problem. Okay, so as usual, you have a long list of all these guys, okay, because there is a long list of the different stories, okay. And as usual, you can choose one of those and view the file or 3D view here. This is I probably sit down. So this is the structure, this is DNA, you can see. And you can see that it's exactly what I showed to you before. So there are helices. Can you see that? There are helices going in the major site, in the major group. Okay. So of course, if you can show the chemical structure, and if you are patient enough, you can see the chemical structures of amino acids going to contact the spares. I'm not spending time now, but just to tell you, okay? So if you want to see the real life of subscription path, you can go there and see. Okay. Good, so the story is that this DNA binding transcription factor take care, because they do not include a number of other proteins that have to do with transcription but do not possess DNA binding domain. Okay, for example, you have, as you know, many enzymes, histone modifiers or DNA modifier, methyltransferases and these guys, and then a number of coactivators or corepressors that are just protein that either make bridging, okay, between transcription factor and something else, or make different kind of activities, okay, or general transcription factor that are the basal pick components. So they are not included in this DNA binding transcription factor category. Okay. But if you go to any of these databases that I showed you before, you can find also something that is not experimental verified. Okay. So, for example, putative proteins with similitude to known transcription factors. I mean, exploration of the gene sequence tells you if they are similar to known transcription factors. And in this case, this gene will go in the database as a transcription factor. So take care that is usually in the description they say verified, experimental verified, or just predicted. Is the difference. Okay? And also proteins that possess structural domains that are similar to DNA binding domain, but are not directly transcription factor. Okay? So this is the story. Do you know this GO? Have you already heard about it? Yes. Oh, this is something that you know. Okay. Good. So if you go to Gene Ontology, you can ask for this category, DNA binding transcription factors, and you find all the list of the transcription factors in our concept. Okay. Let's go through some characters, some features of this transcription factor, and then we stop for a while. I have another additional 10 minutes, then we can stop. And then after the interval, we after the stop, we can go to some methodological points that is important. Okay, this is first is the unbalance of knowledge that we have on different transcription factors. Unbalance means that some of them are known exactly. Okay, as we know the life of Ronaldo, for example, but we don't know anything about some people playing Serie C. Okay, the same story. So we know every team, for example, for P53, this is the number of papers, articles, reporting about P53 in human and non-human in white. This is an old paper, so today it's probably increased. Okay. And this is estrogen receptor. This is FOS, MEK, JUN, androgen receptor, and other factors. This is the inflammatory NFKB1 factor. KREB1, that I showed you in the crystal before. And then STOP. And where are the other 25,000 transcription factors? They are teeny, 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 if any at all. So we, for many of these transcription factors, we don't know anything. So this is not a show up. It's just to tell you that, as usual in biology, we know many, many things on something, and we reflect this knowledge to all the other. But we have no experiment evidence that all the rest function in the same way. It's the same for organisms. I mean, we know everything about Drosophila, and we think that other insects work more or less in the same way, but actually we don't know. Okay, so we have an imbalance in information. It's just to know, to remember. And this is the cellular, this is the biological processes that are regulated by transcription factor. This is another show up of this gene ontology database in which you can classify everything in this function. Now let's see the domains. I talked to you just before about the different structural DBD domains, right? And so look at the numbers. So for example, this zinc finger C2H2, that means that the coordination of the zinc finger is made by two cysteine and two histidines, right? Because there is another type of zinc finger that has a different conformation, okay? We know something like 700 transcription factors which have the same structural domain. So zinc finger. Please note that when I say the same structural domain, doesn't mean the same amino acid sequence. So they all have a different amino acid sequence, okay, but they have the same structural configuration, okay? And there are a lot, really. Okay. Then look for the homeo domain, the one that with three helices that you saw before, the first one. We have something like 270 members show the same domain. Okay. This is helix loop helix. This is the B zip, that is the one with the CREB that we have seen. CREB. It's called B zip. That means basic plus zip leucine, okay? And we are around 50 or 60, okay? This is nuclear hormone receptor, because they have a different configuration of domains, 50. And then many others, but as you can see, we are going down, 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 down. For example, in the past, we have made a number of, in my laboratory, we have studied this guy here, AP2. And as you can see, the report, the number of transcription factors that are in this family are very little. We know five members at all. Only five genes encoding factors with the same domain. Okay, so this is kind of unbalanced story. Okay, and if you look at the distribution, and the evolutionary distribution, again, is not even at all. Okay, if you look at this is the ZNF C2H2, that is the one that is more frequent. okay? And if you look at the distribution in primates, mammals in general, vertebrates, and metazoa in general, you see that it has been an increase of numbers in primates. So it is a motif, a domain, that has been selected in primates versus the other organisms, okay? And on the contrary, if you look at the homo domain, you see here, this is the primate, mammals, vertebrates. So primates and mammals tend to exclude this homeobox domain from the transcription factor. It's quite interesting to see this kind of choice, evolutionary choice of different domains, because it has something to do with evolution in some sense. This is helix again. So actually primates like zinc fingers in some way. So that's the story. Okay, and this is the number of, of course, transcription factors. We saw this a large number of transcription factors. Not all of them, of course, is expressed in each cell type, in each tissue. Okay, so you can evaluate in different tissues there. Okay, appendix, skeletal muscle, skin, heart, tongue, adrenal cortex, liver, kidney, blah, 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 blah. You can look for the number of TFs expressed per tissue. Okay, this is an older study, but I mean, you can change the number, but the figure remains more or less the same. You see that each tissue is a different number, and please note that the placenta and fetal tissues have the high number. They are not completely differentiated tissues, so they express more than the other ones. Okay, and this small dots here, just the ratio, expressed TF over all expressed genes. So it's the ratio, and you see that more or less they stable. Okay, so the percentage of the TFs over all the expressed genes remains more or less constant in all the tissues, but the absolute number of TF expressed is different. Okay? And, oh, wow. Okay, this is terrible, I know. But I showed it to you because you have a similar figure in your textbook. So just to explain what it is. So this is a heat map. Do you know from bioinformatics what a heat map is? Yeah. False scorer. Log 2, and this is the expression of each transcription factor that you have in lines. So each line, each row like this, is a transcription factor. You cannot see the name here. It's completely useless if I put all the names, because it will be written in times Roman 001. So you cannot see them, okay? So, but anyway, each line is a transcription factor, and each column is the same tissues that you saw before. Okay, so different tissues. Whole brain, fetal brain, thymus, blood, uterus, thyroid, placenta, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So at this point, whenever you see a white dot means that it's not expressed. Okay, so if you look, for example, to this transcription factor here that I don't know the name, okay, where I have my pointer here, this is a transcription factor. I go to the line and I see it is expressed only in testes. Okay, this is the code. Clear to all of you? Okay. And this is the color code. That means, you see the logs, that means this is the logarithmic expression of the level of expression of each transcription factor. So when you see red, means that it's expressed not much, but it is. And when you go to blue, means that it's enormously expressed, very high expression. As you can see, in general, transcription factors are not very much expressed. You see that most of them are red. White or red, okay? Only few of them are blue. That means that the expression of very few transcription factors is very high. Okay, in general, it's a quite low expression. And we know very well because it's quite difficult to detect in Western blots. Okay, so that's a problem. Okay, then there are, as you can see, there are factors, lines, in which all the tissues have a color. Can you see? For example, the first here, all the lines have a color. That means that that particular transcription factor is ubiquitary, is expressed in all the tissues examined, of course. Maybe that some of you making the thesis work will find a tissue in which that factor is not expressed. But for the moment, they are expressed in all of them. You can see? Okay? Well, so they ubiquitous expression for transcription factor. There are some, okay, that are really ubiquitous expression, whatever. Okay. And then this is tissue specific. So if you look at those, you go to the line and you see that they are expressed in some more, most of them, or few of them in this section. Okay. So this is gives you an idea that we have ubiquitous transcription factor. Apparently they are useful to all cell types. They probably keep alive transcription of essential genes interpretation, okay? And on the contrary, you are tissue specific. Okay, for example, we in our laboratory we study estrogen receptor. Estrogen receptor is not expressed in all tissues, it's expressed in reproductive tissues, so like breast, endometrium, ovary, okay? Of course. So you have tissue-specific expression of a transcription. Androgen receptor, testes, I mean, everything as well. Okay? Good. We can probably stop here for a minute, let's say 5 minutes, and then we'll start with this analysis. Okay. So what I wanted to discuss with you today, if we have no time today, we're going to continue tomorrow. Because it's a very important aspect for molecular biology, is that how we characterize transcription factor activity. Okay? So the chapters are analysis of DNA binding activity, structural analysis by crystallography, analysis of transactivation properties, close this window, identification of DNA response elements, identification of genome-wide binding activity, okay, identification of cooperating TFs, and protein-protein interaction network, because most of these TFs actually have interaction with other proteins. Okay, so starting with the first, how do we analyze the DNA binding activity of a transcription factor? Interesting point. Well, there is a very old and classical assay for DNA binding, which is this, is the what is called the EMSA or gel shift, depending on the references. This is an in vitro, okay, analysis of the transcription factor binding function. And please note that the binding does not always correlate with transcriptional activity. I mean, here you just measure if a sequence of DNA, a small fragment of DNA, binds or doesn't bind to a transcription factor, right? It's a biochemical assay. So what you need is a nuclear extract from cells or tissues, usually from cells. Okay. How do you make a nuclear extract?
That's
a philosophical definition. Okay, isolating the nuclei is easy. We discussed it already. Okay, hypotonic lysis of the cell, and then centrifugate, and nuclei are very heavy, so blah, they fall down at low speed, no problem. Okay, then you take the nuclei and you extract them. There are several ways, because when you make chromatin immunoprecipitation, for example, if you remember, I put SDS on it. You remember? SDS, what the SDS does? Well, and for everything. Okay, it's a very strong detergent, it's a very strong caltrope, so it disrupts everything. The nucleus, chromatin, blah, blah, everything in solution has a solution, let's say. It's a mess. There's DNA, chromatin, blah, blah, okay? But we don't want to have this mess here. We only want to have factors which bind reversibly, sottolineato tre volte, reversibly bind reversibly to DNA. Okay? So it's not histones. Histones are tightly bound to the DNA because they are so charged. Okay? And DNA is roped around. It's very difficult to resolve them. Okay? You have to use high salt. We don't want that. We only want to extract proteins, transcription factors, that binds reversibly to DNA. If you think about the figures that we have seen, you realize that there are not many chemical bonds in between a transcription factor and DNA. Not many. Okay? Few amino acids interact with it. Okay? So at that point, what you do is to treat your nuclei not with a detergent that will disrupt the membrane, but with a medium salt concentration. So if you make, like we use 400 millimolar potassium chloride, something like this, okay? This ionic bond, these ions will compete with the ionic bond between basic amino acids and the phosphate backbone of DNA, okay? They will salt out this kind of interaction. So in that condition, all the transcription factor will get out of the nuclei for diffusion, okay? Diffusion, then you squeeze the nuclei with the centrifugation and you recover transcription factor on the cell. Okay? If you increase, you go to 1 molar KCl or 2 molar KCl, you will also disrupt interaction DNA histones. So you get histones out of it. Okay? So it's just a question of middle salt. Okay? Middle ionic strength. So this is nuclear extract, what we call nuclear extract. Okay? Then what we do is to make a piece of DNA with a sequence that we know, okay? And we call it double-strand oligo, of course, because it's the oligo. Usually we use something like 50 bases or even shorter, anyway, a small piece of DNA, okay? And we label it. We label usually with P32, that is this relatively short-lived isotope of phosphate, do you know it? Yeah. There is another radioactive isotope of phosphate, of phosphorus, P33. This is a lower energy and longer half-life. Usually, do you know how is the half-life of P32? Okay, I make you a multiple choice question. 10 minutes, 14 days, 14 years. Where you click? Half-life. That means the time in which the radioactivity falls to 50% of the original one. I don't remember the one. Yeah, 2 weeks. 2 weeks. 2 weeks? 2 years. 2 weeks. Okay. This is practical. Okay. Because we have to get rid of it. Okay. So if you use an isotope that is too long living, you have serious problem to waste. Okay. You don't know where to put it. In other words, if you take a short living, if too short is useless because you have to make the experiment in few minutes, so it's difficult to make. If you have short middle, like 2 weeks, 1 week, 10 days, then this you can just leave your waste in a place, wait for 1 year, and then it's gone. Mm. no more adjective. Okay. So no, I just commenting because there is this story about the come si chiama Avelina, quella di Berlusconi, that is dead, let's say that was empoisoned by radioactivity. But actually, after so long time, you cannot know if it is radioactive or not, because if they use it, the short-living isotope, there is no trace of it. Stop the story. Okay, so you have this 33 years oligo, and at this point you make an electrophoresis. Okay? You make an electrophoresis of the complex. Please note that this is completely different from a polyacrylamide SDS page gel. The one that you use for proteins is a denaturing electrophoresis, right? You have SDS in it, so no interactions. In this point, this is a native gel, that means that it's acrylamide, but the condition of salt, ionic strand, no detergent, whatever, will keep interaction, okay? And also we have to refrigerate the gel, because the way it eats up and the interaction is destroyed. So we usually run this kind of gel in the cold room, like in a fridge, okay, to be low temperature, okay? Okay, so what you get is a complex, okay, complex, and you can have complex either with your transcription factor or with any other protein that bind to it, okay, in a specific way, maybe, because DNA is charged, okay, and the proteins are alpha-ionic, so it will happen that they actually interact aspecifically. And the free oligo, since it's very light, will run at the end of the gel. Okay, so this is complex. If you don't see the complex, means that you have no interaction. If you see a complex, means that you have interaction. And if you have more than one bend at a different molecular weight, it means that you have more than one interaction. Okay, good. So let me see one experiment of this kind. I take a oligo containing a sequence, okay, and I label it. This red means that I label it, and then I put extract. Nuclear extract contains many proteins, okay, and some of them will bind to the fragments, some will not. So after incubation, I have different kind of complexes. Either free protein is not labeled, I don't see on the gel, or free DNA is labeled, I see on the gel. Or complexes A, complexes B. And since they have different molecular masses, I see as a separate bend. Okay? Now, how can I know that this is a specific, means transcription factor binding to its sequence and the other one is not? I compete it. Okay? So I put in the mix, when I make this kind of incubation, I put in the mix increasing amount of the same oligo unlabeled. Okay? The same fragment, the same sequence, but unlabeled. Okay? So it will compete with the labeled probe to bind to the protein. Now, this is increasing concentration of competing unlabeled. Okay? And you see that this band goes away. On the contrary, this other band doesn't go away. And this means that this is unspecific interaction with your oligo, and this is specific interaction with your oligo. Have you got the point? Not really?
Wouldn't all bands?
No. Okay, imagine that you have a component of the nuclei, for example, I don't know, histones or whatever, a charged protein, okay? A negatively charged protein that interacts specifically with DNA, because DNA, non-negative, positive, sorry, basic protein that interacts with DNA, aspecifically, just phosphate backbone protein interaction, okay? This will not be competed out by this, because this fragment will compete only to this complex, not to the other one, okay? you have enormous amount of proteins, enormous amount of DNA in your mix. So if you compete with the specific sequences, mean that that complex is the specific one. Okay. Then you can also make other kind of experiments to say if it is really that transcription factor binding to your sequence. For example, you can use a antibody. Okay, so in the mix that you make here, you also add an antibody which recognizes specifically your transcription factor, the blue one. Okay, so in that case, you will have your protein plus oligo complex, and then you will have a higher molecular weight complex between the oligo, your protein, plus the antibody. Okay, this is called super shift because the fragment is shifted by interaction with your protein and is super shifted when you add the antibody. Okay? So we use this kind of assay to say, okay, this factor binds to this sequence or not. Okay? Then you can use, for example, mutated oligos. Okay, this is a real life experiment we made in the lab several years ago. Doesn't publish it, okay? So we have, this is the original sequence in our DNA. Only one strand is shown, but of course you use double strand DNA in the assay. And this is another similar sequence we found in another story. And as you can see, this is a modified sequence. So you can evaluate the competition of these sequences with the original one. So you see that when you increase this kind of guy, there is no change here, no change here. Sometimes you have wild type sequence that competes out the band, okay? And this is a super shift. So adding an antibody against this AP2 protein, you have a super shift. So it demonstrates that these oligos bind to this AP2 protein. And just to show you how a real life, and this black story here, this is the oligo, the free oligo. Since you put a lot of them, you see a lot of black story in the autoradiography. Okay, then, going to the second one, we saw already the crystallography, so I don't want to go through. But of course, just to tell you that crystallography is an important piece of work. Actually, usually it's not made by the same people. Biologists and molecular biologists, they do experiments in, you know, wet lab or something. Crystallography is a very special story. Okay, so some laboratory in the world make crystallography. It's difficult to make crystals. It's difficult to find the diffraction. The apparatus to make diffraction is not very usual, it's not common, and so. But it's a very important information because, of course, whenever you have a complex of DNA with a factor, it means that it exists as a complex. You see it, okay, and you can characterize the direct interaction. Okay, this is just to show. This is a nuclear receptor bound to the DNA, and you see that this is the zinc figure with the alpha helix there. You remember zinc finger is a helix and then two beta sheets there. You see them? Beta sheets and alpha helix, and the zinc finger is more or less here. Okay. By the way, the nuclear receptor is one of the few transcription factors for which the transactivator domain is also crystallized. But just because it binds to a ligand, the hormone, so it has to be a fixed structure. Anyway, you just look at this. Just to say that, okay, you can see all the structure that you want. We have already visited this site, so we can skip. Analysis, then chapter 3, analysis of transactivation property. For definition, a transcription factor is a protein that binds to the DNA, but also that regulates the transcription, right? Okay. So how can we analyze this property. So to activate or repress, anyway, to have an effect on transcription. So what we use is a reporter assay. A reporter assay means that you have a reporter gene that is something that is not usually expressed in your cell, okay? And then you have a piece of promoter DNA and something in which you have the transcription factor response element. So you have the sequences that you have seen before on the J shift analysis that binds to your transcription factor, okay? Then you can manage to activate your transcription factor in the cell with a signaling pathway or whatever, okay? This is nucleus, this is cytoplasm, this is the membrane, this is the receptor. So for example, you are studying the CREB1 protein that we showed you before. You can put hormones. The hormones will increase the cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP will phosphorylate the transcription factor and activate the transcription factor, okay? So if you have a CREB response element here, you can see the reporter gene activated, okay? And then the reporter gene will encode for a protein that you see somewhere in the cell, okay? So you take a construct like this, okay? You construct a plasmid using normal recombinant technologies. You assemble a plasmid with a reporter gene that is driven by a promoter. This is the promoter. And then upstream, it has the sequence that we have to realize, to analyze, okay? Then you take this plasmid, you grow in Escherichia coli, you purify, and then you finally transfect on a cell line, whatever you want, okay? So you have your monolayer of cultured cells, you make a transfection, like usual, and then you leave the time for the transcriptional apparatus and protein synthesis, whatever, to express this reporter protein, okay? So usually you have 24 to 72 hours, more or less, okay? And then you can measure the product of your reporter gene in the cell, depending on the kind of reporter genes. You use these are the different stories that usually we utilize, that this is the oldest one. This is the chloramphenicol acetyltransferase, or CAT, that is the protein that is encoded by a resistance, bacterial resistance to chloramphenicol. It will brought acetyl residue to the chloramphenicol molecule, okay? And so we use the radioactive assay. So after a while, we extract the cells and we make an enzymatic assay of chloramphenicol acetyltransferase. That is, you give chloramphenicol plus C14 labeled acetate, and if you have the enzyme, it will bind to the other one. Okay, so you make a kind of thin layer chromatography and see the dots of the chromatography. But it's an old story. It uses radioactive, so nobody uses now today, but just to know that it existed, okay? Then we have the modern version. This is the most used ever. This is the firefly luciferase. Do you know what is a firefly? Lucula, okay? As you know, the lucula make light because they have an enzyme that is luciferase that takes ATP and gives a photon, okay? So you can use this enzyme that is not normally expressed by mammalian cells. If you don't use the firefly as an experimental organism, you can use firefly forever, okay? So, and this is a very convenient assay because after transfection, you just take extract of the cell, you put some ATP inside, and with a luminometer, you can measure the light. And the light will be proportional to the amount of luciferase expressed in cells, okay? So if you have activation, you see light, otherwise. Then somebody sometimes they use the GFP that you know, or sometimes you can use beta-galactosidase that you remember. Beta-galactosidase clears all the beta-galactosidase. You can use the EPDG or XGAL to see the product. Okay, so it's not used in vivo, not in vitro. In vitro, in the cells, usually people use this. It's the most convenient one. Okay. And importantly, this assay, the reporter gene, is also important because you can make any kind of deletional, mutational tricks on your fragment. Okay, so you have a fragment that you don't know exactly how it is composed. You can make deletions, for example, cutting shorter from one side, as in the case of minimal promoter I told you before, or mutate single nucleotide to see which is the sequence that is important to the response. It's very convenient. Okay, so this is just to show you how a kind of vector is made. So you have the luciferase gene here, that of course is followed by a poly A signal, and then you have a selectable marker because you have to grow in the Escherichia coli, as usual, plasmids grow in Escherichia coli, this is the ORI, and this is the ampicillin resistance, and this is the upstream element, and this, you have multiple cloning regions to put your sequences, okay? So you can interrogate whatever. There is another version of the luciferase, that is the Renilla luciferase, that has a different light of emission. So if you need to make a control, because you want to examine your luciferase, you reported, but for example, you have difficulty in transfecting cells. To evaluate the efficiency of transfection, you can use another vector with this Renilla and measure the ratio between the two. Anyway, this is a sophisticated story, but just to let you know that this is very convenient biotechnological products for this kind of assay. Actually, there are many companies that sell a kit in which you have a vector with luciferase, a vector with Renilla, all the reagents to make transfection, all the reagents to evaluate luciferase at the end, so it's quite easy to track. It doesn't require any particular equipment in the lab. Okay, so quite common. Okay, the advantages of reporter assays is this high throughput. So you can have very high numbers of mutants, reporters, whatever. There are formats in the functional laboratories of genomic research in which they use, you know, these 96 well plates to make different kind of reporters with different fragments. So you can study in a very convenient high throughput way. You can measure mutation in promoters, in the enhancer, whatever. And they have large dynamic range in the sense that you can evaluate very little activity and very high activity. So it works in very high range. Okay. You have different reporters and can be used in vivo. This is also very important. So you can use the same kind of technology making transgenic animals. Okay, so you can see the effect of your reporter directly in the animals. Of course, there are contraindication weakness of the method. First is that you use exogenous DNA, so you put plasmids in the cells. What is the difference between exogenous DNA and endogenous DNA from the regulatory point of view? Please. Anybody of you answer? When you transfect the plasmid in a cell line, okay, which is the main difference in between in the DNA that you transfect and the DNA that is endogenous? Yes. Chromatin structure. The plasmid won't be chromatinizing, of course. Okay, so you are studying naked DNA. So you cannot measure the effect of yeasts and blah blah on it, okay. Second, you have problems of gene dosage because usually when you put plasmid, you put millions of copies, okay. So you have effects like squelching, for example, not enough transcription factor to regulate, okay. you remember that the most of the transcription factors are expressed very low. So you have too many promoters, copies of promoters to regulate, there will be not enough. Okay. And since you have to transfect, you know that not all cell types are easily transfected. There are many cell lines that don't like much to be transfected. You cannot use in assays. Okay, but this is not a problem. Okay, I had another slide. I lost it. There was a in vivo. Okay, forget. So I mean, was a slide showing you a mouse in which there was a knock-in transgenization of a reporter in which you can study the expression in tissues during development. Okay. Actually, next time. Okay. Going to the other story is the identification of DNA response element. Okay, so what we call TFBS. And this is made by, essentially by several technologies. This DNase-1 footprinting is used whenever you have a fragment that you know that contains something responsive to a transcription factor, but you don't know where. Imagine to have fragments like, I don't know, 500 bases, okay, so quite long. You know the transcription factor binds only, let's say, 10 to 15 base pairs in the sequence. You don't know which sequence is bound, so you can use this guy. This guy is called a DNA footprinting because you use DNase-1 that you know. So you take DNA, not the difference, this is naked DNA in vitro, it's not chromatin. So nothing to do with the DNase assay that we studied in the chromatin, okay? Just you have your labeled DNA, that is, of course, is a cloned piece of DNA and so on. And then you label by one end. It's important by one end, but not by both of them, okay? And then you make incubation with, for example, nuclear extract in which there is your DNA binding protein or a transcription factor expressed, purified, or expressed as a recombinant protein, okay? It will bind to a specific region in your fragment, okay? At this point, you use DNase-1, limited, so you put just a little of DNase in the reaction. If you put a lot of DNase, you will destroy completely the DNA. Okay? So you put a thin amount of DNase in order that makes one cut per fragment. Okay? Since DNase has no activity has no specificity for sequences, it will cut wherever. Except that in the part where the protein is bound. Okay? The part where the protein is bound is protected, we say, from digestion. Okay? So you get all the possible fragments, okay? Except that the ones that are covered by the protein. Okay? So you run one reaction in which no protein, on your left side, no protein, so no protection, and you get all the possible fragments, okay? Here, you have added the protein, so fragment protected, you see some fragment, then a footprint, that means cuts that could not be made by DNA, and then the other ones, okay? So this is a sequencing gel, so a gel capable of distinguishing fragments of DNA that differ only by one nucleotide to each other, okay? So it's a lathering gel, it's acrylamide gel, okay? And you see all the fragments here, footprints there. Okay, this is another slide telling exactly the story. Protein protects this region, all the fragments, no cut here, so you have a footprint over there. Okay? Real life, experiment, real life experiment. This is each shock protein is 70 gene promoter, and these are proteins of the, you know, the peak that we talked before, that are being incubated with this promoter, okay? And this is the ladder. So when you put TBP, this is the un-protein, so no protein here, you see almost all the fragments. Don't be surprised that the fragments are, some of them are light, some of them are darker, just because the DNA is unspecific, but so. So it prefers some sequence. But anyway, and as you can see, when I put TBP, that will bind to the Tata box, this Tata box is protected. See? No cuts. Then I put another protein, that is this TEF25, and they will cover the initiation, so the plus 1 to plus 25, you see? Here are all the protected fragments. Okay. So these are the footprinting experiments. So you know the sequence from here to here, you can say, okay, that particular transcription factor binds to this sequence. This is a promoter example, it's not really fit, but you can do it with the normal transcription factor binding, okay, wherever you want. Okay. So there are other methods to study this DNA binding specificity. And the first route is to make this kind of gel shift with mutation inside to see which kind of mutation will eliminate binding. And the second route is to make in vitro assay that is called Celex. I'm going to explain you shortly. And the third route that is very, very much explored today is to have a great number of sequences that are bound by the same factor, okay? Genomic sequences that are bound by the same factor, and to explore them bioinformatically to find the frequent motif inside. Have you done it already in bioinformatics? You will do. You will see tomorrow morning how is that. Anyway, okay. So the Celex is a procedure that was really used in the past, and it's just a story like putting a recombinant transcription factor. So you have a recombinant purified transcription factor in your test tube, okay? And you make a library of DNA oligos of any sequence. Terrible. N. Okay? Then you mix the two, and your transcription factor will probably bind only some of the sequences, okay? Because of its specificity, okay? Good. If your transcription factor is bound to a solid something, like Sepharose or whatever, okay? So you can select, this is the name, select means, select some sequences, okay? So in the very first classical Celex, you make a small column containing Sepharose and your transcription factor, and then you put your library of random sequences over it, okay? Then you elute and pass again, and elute and pass again, and blah, 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 several cycles, until you purify only the best, say, the best sequences, okay? Today we have NGS, so no need to make all this kind of painstaking story. You just make one single selection step with your protein, and then you sequence what is bound to it, okay? You sequence all, and then you find the most frequent sequence over it. This is a very good way to find initial specificity for a transcription factor. The problem is that, one, you need purified or recombinant expressed transcription factor. So this is a limitation, of course. And the second limitation is that transcription factor probably never bind alone. So sometimes you have different specificity when you compare the real in vivo situation with the synthetic, say, in vitro story. And finally, of course, you have chromatin immunoprecipitation. Okay, so we have still 5 minutes. We finish with this chromatin immunoprecipitation that you know already. That means to put an antibody to chromatin preparation, and so you can identify the sequence that is bound by a specific protein, transcription factor. Okay, so the strength is that this is in vivo situation. Okay, so you remember you work with chromatin, real life chromatin. Okay, and then finally you can detect the sequence that is bound by PCR. So this means that you have a very sensitive assay. Okay. And the weakness is that it's difficult to make. Requires long training means that it's difficult to make. Not all the students, when get for the first time in the lab, will make a cheap experiment. This requires some trick. It's not really very easy. Second problem is that it requires very good antibodies. We discussed it already, because most of the transcription factors are embedded in complexes. So you cannot, all the surfaces are hidden from the antibody, and does not exactly tell you where on DNA the protein is binding, because you remember random fragments of chromatin. So when you sequence the fragment, for example, from here to here, you have not limiting to the small sequences that is bound by the transcription factor, but the higher region, to a larger region. Okay. So cheap steps, you know, because we discussed it many times, okay? You go to PC ready chip DNA, and then you make PCR. Can I skip it? You know, the flow, we discussed it several times. And finally, for the chip typically gives a lot of results, in the sense that if you run a chip experiment, you have a lot of results, too much. You require really good controls, because first of all, you have to have a positive control. That means a gene that has been previously been shown to be bound by the factor. So you know that your reaction works, because sometimes your reaction, your antibody, and blah, blah, they work. Second, you have to control for negative, because actually an antibody with proteins, they will precipitate a lot of fragments. Okay, also unspecifically. So you have to use an unrelated genomic region to be sure that what you precipitate actually is a correct story. And then you have to make the same reaction with normal IgG. So IgG that do not recognize any transcription factor, just to make sure that what you see is not a specific. Okay? And that's it for today. Tomorrow we will start with the chip analysis genome-wide, so the ChIP-seq, and you will see how from a library of sequences we can derive the small element. Okay.